Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
All right, so let me start with last night's matchup between the Nets and the Cavs. They faced off in Cleveland last night, and it did mark the return of an elite guard. An elite guard who had been away from the game for a couple of weeks. Everybody was locking it in to see how he would look and how he would gel with his teammates. And after one night, the answer is amazing, tremendous. No, I'm not talking about Kyrie Irving, who was on the floor for the Nets last night. Instead, I'm talking about Colin freaking Sexton, who had missed the last five games for the Cavaliers. And he came back like an absolute legend after missing five games with that sprained ankle. Young Bull returned to put up 42 points. He buried the Nets, 147-135 in double OT. Last night was the first time that Brooklyn's big three had played together. It was the first time that Kyrie took the court after his, quote, pause in the season and after the James Harden trade. It also was the Jarrett Allen revenge game. But in reality, this one was all about Colin Sexton. That was a supernova performance. Young Bull ran wild. 16 of 29 from the field. 5 of 11 from deep. He was the best player on the floor last night. And I guarantee you, nobody was thinking about saying that before last night. I'm sure there were even some people who weren't even convinced that he'd be the fourth best player on the floor last night. But there he was, on top of the heap, and he had it all working. There he was, blocking Kevin Durant on the break.
Break opportunity. Durant, long strides, and taken away by Sexton. What a defensive play.
That's the Yes Network. And more importantly, that 6'1" rejecting a 7-footer. And he was getting it done, distributing the ball from, well, everywhere and anywhere. He found Larry Nance Jr. from deep to tie it up with less than a minute left in overtime.
Allen comes and gets it, gives it back to Sexton once again. Calling on Irving to the bucket, blocked by Kyrie. Sexton got it back. Nance for the tie. He knocks it down.
Cavs Network. And then the three over Kyrie to send it into double OT with less than 2 seconds left in overtime.
Sexton, his team down by three for the tie. He's got it! 1.2 to play! Colin Sexton! We are all knotted up at 127. The Nets elected not to foul, and it cost them. Sexton sticks it.
Have some. And now have some more. Because if Sexton was good in regulation and overtime, this guy was incredible in double overtime. 4 threes. 15 points, including this dagger in Durant's eye.
36 overall for Sexton. Now he's got the taller Durant. Sexton lets it fly. Again, Colin Sexton is locked in.
I don't know what's better. 6'1 blocking a 7-footer or 6'1 shooting over a 7-footer? The answer is yes. So what's happening in Cleveland right now? Hey, don't worry. I can handle that for you. I have your answer. It is a bleeping renaissance. It started with the Browns. It's continuing now with the Cavs. The Cavs picked up right where the Browns left off. The hottest city in sports right now is C-Town. I could not be any prouder. Still, there are a lot of dopes and losers and haters that are going to think that the real story from last night was the Nets and how they looked in their first game with the big three. Of all the possible results that people were expecting when Kyrie finally did join up with Kevin Durant and James Harden, of all the possible looks from the new-look Brooklyn Nets, I'm not sure anybody had them getting worked by the Cavaliers in double OT. Now, I'm not going to come out after only one game and say that there's no way they'll win a championship. It was only one night. It was their first game together. Irving and Harden are still working themselves into shape, but dang. If you're looking to be the best team in the East, that's not the best start. Before the game, Durant got the team together and said, quote, let's start something beautiful. And then they went out and they got worked by Cleveland. Yeah, I mean, there was something beautiful last night. There was, except it was wearing black Cavaliers jerseys with ransom note font. Kyrie played a career-high 48 minutes last night. Durant played 50. Harden played 51. They went for 37, 38, and 21, respectively. They combined for 96, and that still was not enough to beat Colin Sexton and the Cavaliers. And let me be clear about this. The Cavaliers have the worst offensive rating in the NBA. The worst offensive rating in the league, and they still nearly went for a buck and a half against the Nets. Not only that, they weren't even at full strength. That wasn't even the Sexland Cavaliers. I mean, Sexton was there. Easy, Rick. Sexton was, but his running mate, the other half of Sexland, Darius Garland, was not there. In other words, this was a shorthanded Cavaliers team that dropped nearly a buck 50 on the Nets. And how were they doing it? They were doing it with moments like this. I'm not sure what anybody expected, Rit. I mean, you don't expect the Nets to look like the bad boys on Pistons or the bad boy Pistons on defense, right? I get that. I understand that. We all know this. But come on, fellas. You can't beat turnstiles. And worst of all, they couldn't get stops when they had to have them. Steve Nash said it, quote, "We had breakdowns all over the place. So we have a lot of work to do. We know we have a very offensive team right now, so we have to find ways to defend. Get connected. Be on the same page." End quote. Man, that is the truth. There were breakdowns all over the place. If you had questions about how the Nets' big three would show up on defense before last night, then you have even more questions right now. I mean, they weren't exactly known for locking people up defensively, and that was before the Jared Allen deal. Now that Allen is protecting the rim in Cleveland, the defense has even more questions. So, of course, these questions don't matter right this second. It's January. You don't need to be an elite defense in January. But if you want to win in June, this group better get better. You're not going to win a seven-game series with teams like the Heat or the Bucks if you can't get stops against the Cavs. I know. It's January. It's only one game. There is no doubt they can score the ball. The question is, can they get stops? And after one night, the answer is no. No, they can't. They got to figure it out. And they have to figure it out on the fly because it is a packed season. There are not that many practices. And if this team is going to live up to the hype, they have to get the stops. We know they can score it. What we don't know is if they can stop it. And if the worst shooting team in the NBA is going off like that against them, then the answer is no. They can't get stops. And if they can't get stops, there are not going to be any parades in Brooklyn. I would imagine after a really good workout, you're craving some protein. So where do you go to get it? Change up. Don't make a shake. Don't eat a bar. Grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper instead. Hear me out. Why Old Trapper? Because Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty. It's tender. It's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a wood fire. And it's a family-owned business. They take their smoked beef extremely seriously. You can taste it in every single bite. I mean, who wants dried, tough beef in a bag? Nobody. It's like eating an old shoe. Old Trapper, though, is the real deal. Comes in four amazing flavors. Old Fashioned, Teriyaki, Peppered, and Hot and Spicy. So the next time you want a great protein and energy snack that you can have anytime, anywhere, grab some Old Trapper beef jerky. Look for it in the Clearview bag. That way you can see exactly what you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? We're joined right now by the UFC president, friend of the program, UFC 257, Poirier McGregor 2 from Fight Island, Saturday night, 10 p.m. Eastern. It's on ESPN+. Plus. We are joined by Dana White. Dana, it's great to have you back. Dana, it is fight week. You had a card yesterday. Now you're 2 days away from UFC 257 and the return of Conor. Dana, how fired up are you for Saturday?
I'm so pumped, man. You know, we had the press conference today. It was very cordial, and everybody was very polite to each other. But I know that these fights are going to be ridiculous on Saturday.
All right, so, Dana, in terms of that press conference, I saw the video. You posted the video of the stare-down between Conor and Dustin. How would you describe the mood and the energy when the two of them faced off against each other a few hours back?
Yeah, great point. You know, it was very cordial and everything else, but the face-off, the stare-down, was badass. It was awesome. It was a good as good of a stare down as you'll ever see.
We're talking to Dana White. All right, so it's going to be a rematch, of course. Take me back. What do you remember about their first fight? What stands out to you the most about the days leading up to that and the fight itself?
Well, it was obviously a very different atmosphere. These guys were at each other's throat, both guys trying to get in each other's heads. And then Conor went out and put on an unbelievable performance and knocked him out.
We are talking to Dana White. This fight's coming up on Saturday night. You know, Dana, you and I have talked so much in the past about the questions surrounding Conor's motivation, right? I mean, you pointed this out. When somebody gets a lot of money, suddenly getting hit in the face does not seem like it's as much fun. What is your sense as to where his motivation is right now, and what kind of Conor are you expecting to see Saturday night?
Yeah, no, he's a completely different kid right now. He's the old Conor. And when you're dealing with this Conor, it makes fight week really fun. And if you watch the press conference, he has this moment where somebody asks him that. So his answer to that question was, what motivates me? Highlights. He said, you know what? Money comes and goes. And what fires me up is we're still watching highlights of Mike Tyson and Ali and Roy Jones Jr. And I'm going to have so many highlights you can make a movie out of it. It's the way that he said it and the way that he laid it out was beautiful. And you can tell where his head is at right now.
So what do you think?
I love it.
Yeah, it was Dana White joining us. Like, I've been watching hype videos. I mean, there really is nobody like this guy, especially when he's right. Like, Dana, do you think that was there some kind of switch that went off? Did he do some deep soul searching? Did something fundamentally change in him, or does he just miss being the guy?
Yeah, I think he misses. I do think he misses being the guy, and I think that this business is crazy, and when you take some time off and get away from a minute, you start to crave it again, and you want that action, and you want to get back in there, and I truly do believe that the kid loves the game.
Dana White's joining us once again. So, Dana, earlier this month you had said that your relationship with Conor hit, quote, a bad place last year. How would you describe where it's at right now? How'd you guys go about fixing that?
Yeah, I didn't think that it was going to be fixable, but we did. You know, we talked and we got through it, and we're in a really good place now. So I'm glad it worked out.
All right, so he had huge plans for 2020 following that win over the Cowboy, and then came the pandemic, and like the rest of the world, his 2020 did not go according to plan. What does his 2021 look like to you? Are you expecting to see him fight multiple times this year?
Well, you know, Oliveira just had that unbelievable performance against Tony Ferguson. We got Dan Hooker, who's ranked number 6, taking on Michael Chandler, who, you know, is coming into the UFC for the first time. He fought elsewhere and has had a great career. So we'll see how that plays out. And then you got Poirier versus McGregor. And now we're still talking about, could Khabib possibly fight one more fight? It's this division is exciting, it's fun, and it's never been more exciting than it is right now.
I would agree with you. I think that not only, Dana, is this division as good as it's ever been, I'm not sure that any division in the UFC has ever been as good as the 155 division is right now. What about Dustin? Getting lost in all this, right, is a really good fighter, a really dangerous fighter. How would you describe where Poirier is right now as a fighter and a person?
Yeah, it's true. I agree with you and think he's completely being overlooked by everyone. But this kid's got 12 wins by knockout, 7 by submission. He's got 12 first round finishes, and he has fought everybody, man. He beat Holloway, he beat Pettis, he beat Alvarez. I mean, you name it, this guy's fought them all.
He's had some enormous wins. And then what did he show you in that war, that win over Dan Hooker last summer?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing with Poirier. Poirier goes out and literally throws down and goes to war. I don't know if, you know, when he first got caught the first time that he fought Conor, you know, Conor went on, you know, to become Conor McGregor. So now we know how good Conor is. Now Dustin knows how good Conor is. Dustin isn't the same fighter he was last time they fought. So it's going to be. Well, listen, Conor is saying he's going to knock him out in under 60 seconds. And that would be ridiculous, except for the fact that Conor has done a lot of things he said he would do.
Well, he's done that already to this guy. But, you know, the line of thinking there, Dana, is right. The thing about Connor is that he's going to start so fast and he's so dangerous early on. But if you can weather the first two rounds, cardio and stamina are always an issue. I mean, is that literally what this fight comes down to? How do you see it playing out?
You laid it out perfectly. That's if you talk to anybody who considers themselves an expert, they will say Connor is going to come out fast and go after him like he did Cowboy. And if Poirier can get through a round and a half, Connor will start to slow down and cardio is going to become a factor.
Can't wait to see that. Dana, before I let you go, what about some of the other things going on? Dan Hooker and Michael Chandler also fighting Saturday. How do you see that fight going?
It's Michael Chandler's first fight. It's his debut in the UFC. You know, this kid's got 9 knockouts, 7 submissions. He's a Division I All-American wrestler. He's got 12 first-round finishes, and it's his first time in fighting in the UFC. And not only in the big show, but in the biggest show, you know, a co-main event of a Conor McGregor fight. So I'm sure he's feeling a lot of pressure, and, you know, he's going in against a guy in Hooker who is a very, very nasty guy.
Dana White joining us for a few more moments. Dana, you mentioned Khabib. So you had a meeting with him. I'm curious, what was that conversation like? And do you get the sense that he's motivated to continue fighting?
I do. I think that he still wants to fight. And, you know, he's looking at, you know, I beat all these guys. You know, what's the next challenge for me? Let's see how this thing goes this weekend. If somebody looks really good, maybe. I just feel like he decided to retire under a ton of pressure. You know, his dad just died. He didn't spend time with his family because he was in camp. He got injured and had a hard time cutting weight because of the injury. Goes in, fights the fight, and I think he made an emotional decision. So we'll see how this thing plays out this weekend. He's coming out to Vegas. And he and I are going to go to dinner. And he said, the one thing I won't do is I will never hold up the division. So if I decide that I'm not going to fight one of these guys, I'm retired and the belt can move on.
Dana White, my guest. You know, Danny, it's January now of 2021. You and I spoke a number of times throughout 2020 as you were dealing with trying to keep a professional sport going throughout a pandemic. When nobody else was trying to do that at that time, you've accomplished a ton in your career, but you said, quote, this is the number one accomplishment of my career because this is the hardest thing I've ever done, end of quote. So looking back, why did you do that? Why was that so important to you personally?
Because I felt that I could. There's three things. I felt I could do it because I knew I would spend whatever it cost to figure it out. Number two, I knew my employees would go. And number three, I knew the fighters would fight. So we just had to figure. And at the end of the day, I have this philosophy, this way of living. Listen, man, this is America. We're Americans. We've been figuring things out since the beginning of this, you know, since this country started. What we don't do is we don't quit and we don't hide in our houses, man. We get out and we find solutions to problems.
Dana White joining us. One last thought, Dan. I'm curious. Like, you're always, man, you're just going. You're always going forward. You're always into the next thing.
Yeah, I'm sure you look good.
So my question is, like, what did you learn about yourself and your organization in terms of dealing with challenges and obstacles? What's the biggest takeaway after that?
Yeah, well, listen, it was hard building this business from the beginning. But going through this pandemic and just the media and the networks and the, you name it, all the people that were trying to stop us and make sure that the fight in California and then the fight in Florida didn't happen was unbelievable. And the fact that we fought through it, we ended up winning, we ended up doing it, and we ended up proving everybody wrong, was obviously a massive accomplishment. But we didn't lay off any of our employees. We didn't cut anybody's salaries, and we honored every one of our fighters' contracts. So I think as a sport, as a company, I've become so much stronger and have such a tighter relationship, not just with my employees, but with my fighters.
UFC 257, Saturday, 10 p.m. Eastern on ESPN+. Poirier, McGregor 2, and a great fight card. He is the president of the UFC, Dana White. Dana, great to have you on. Good luck this weekend. I'll be watching. We all will. And it's always good to talk to you.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate it.
And then you've got the AFC Championship game coming up. In fact, you've got both championship games coming up. And the biggest question going into the games this weekend is the status of Patrick Mahomes. Makes sense, right? He's only the league MVP, only the reigning Super Bowl MVP, only the guy at the controls of the scariest and most explosive offense in football. So, of course, his status is going to be monitored like the stock market or Bitcoin, because there are millions and millions and millions riding on his status. Now, the mystery surrounding his status against the Bills, there's even more to the mystery. Like, exactly what happened to him? What happened to Mahomes? Because initially, he was put into the concussion protocol, so everybody assumed it was a blow to the head. But then there was a report that it was actually a neck injury instead. And then there was the fact that he had a hard time standing up, but then he jogged off into the locker room. And then in addition to all that, there is a toe injury that he also suffered. So as a result, people are trying to figure out exactly what's going on, and they're scrutinizing the injury report more than ever before. Understandably, right? It's a completely different game if Chad Henne is playing instead of Patrick Mahomes. Like, I don't know, maybe it's a bad analogy, but a meal, I probably shouldn't do that, we're in a fast. A meal is a completely different meal if you fire up a grill and you throw some dog food on it instead of a sirloin. Yeah, I know how many weapons that there are in that offense, just like I know how good Andy Reid and Eric Bieniemy are. And I know what Chad Henne did in the fourth quarter against Cleveland. But even the most diehard KC fan could not tell you they feel as confident in Henne as they do Mahomes. Of course. This is why it was significant that Kansas City initially announced that Mahomes had been a full participant in practice yesterday. That sounds good. It sounds promising. But then they changed his entry to limited in the practice. Mike Garofalo of the NFL Network said yesterday's practice was, quote, a glorified walkthrough. So if it were a full practice, he would have been limited. Andy Reid used the same word himself.
Yeah, so he looked good. He's just, he's in the protocol. So there's only certain things he can do, and it's a limited basis, but he took all the snaps and he feels good. So, I mean, we're just going to follow this protocol.
So once again, the key words here, protocol and limited. And according to reports, that's pretty much as it should be. Like, you shouldn't read too much into the fact that the practice was a glorified walkthrough, because most practices this time of year are glorified walkthroughs. Coaches and teams do not want their guys going full bore the week of the conference championship game. So the fact that it's, quote, a glorified walkthrough really is not a change that the team is making for Mahomes. It probably would have been a glorified walkthrough anyway. Him taking all of the snaps may or may not be a good thing or a bad thing as it relates to Sunday either. You know, and then you've got the concussion protocol itself. It's something we hear about all the time, but suddenly everybody is an expert on the protocol. According to the Washington Post, the NFL bolstered its protocol for the 2018 season to require a concussion evaluation, quote, for all players demonstrating gross motor instability, e.g. stumbling or falling to the ground when trying to stand, to determine the cause of the instability, end quote. Boy, that's a hell of a line, isn't it? Gross motor instability. I think I had that last Friday night. But I was in my backyard. Gross motor instability. Hey, what do I know? I'm no wordsmith, but it sure seems like Patrick Mahomes had, quote, gross motor instability when he tried to stand up and was wobbling around. And then you've got the question of the protocol itself and how one advances through the protocol to return to the field. And here's the key piece. Everybody involved makes it very, very clear it's not the team's decision. It's not up to the player. It's not up to the team, nor should it be. Because I guarantee if it were, Mahomes would have been right back out there. He would have gone right back out there, even with that gross motor instability. You know why? He's tough as hell, and because almost every player would go right back out there. That's why they don't leave it up to the player. That's why they don't leave it up to the team. The protocol is a five-step process. Quickly, here's the breakdown from the Post. The first phase involves rest and limited activities until the player can progress under the supervision of the athletic training staff to light aerobic exercise. Phase two involves increased cardiovascular exercise. The third phase allows for practice with the team in football-specific exercise for 30 minutes or fewer with careful monitoring. The player can participate in non-contact football activities in Phase 4. And the final phase involves being cleared medically for full on-field participation and contact. Listen, I know why they do that. I know why they lay it out like that. I feel like I need to be in protocol just reading it. But I know why they do it. After the player is cleared by the team physician, he must then be examined and separately cleared by an independent neurological consultant jointly approved by the league and the NFL Players Association and not affiliated with any NFL team. So there you have it. In other words, Patrick Mahomes has to work his way through all of that this week. Those are the phases that he needs to work through. The question then is, how long does that take? Can you do that in a week? If so, then he's going to go out there with, quote, limited practice and probably doesn't matter a hell of a lot. He is Patrick Mahomes. But if he runs out of time and the clock hits zero, then Kansas City's got to go into the biggest game of the season with Chad Henne under center. And I don't care how much faith you have in those weapons and that coach and his play calling and the coordinator. There's no KC fan that wants that. Not against a really dangerous Bills team. Hell, even Ariel Helwani does not want that. Listen, you can rain out baseball. You can rain out tennis. You can rain out golf, but you cannot rain out life. Sometimes, no matter how hard it's coming down out there, you've just got to get in your car, brave the elements, and get to the people who need you most. That's why you need windshield wipers that you can trust. You need wipers from Bosch. Rated by Fortune as 2020's number one auto parts supplier, Bosch makes high-performance windshield wipers that handle the harshest weather conditions so you can reach life's important moments. See what matters most with Bosch. Lorenzo Alexander. Lorenzo, good to have you back. What's up? How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. Yourself, brother?
Good, Lo. Good. So good to have you back. I want to ask you, you and I have talked so often over the years, both as a player and even after you retired last season. Lorenzo, talk to me. How was your first full season of retirement? What was that like for you?
It was really good. You know, it was a decision that I made over the last 4 years, and so I was ready to move on. My body definitely thanked me throughout the year as I watched these games be played, especially as the weather got cold. But it really gave me a time to spend time with my family. Obviously, with the pandemic, got a lot of time because you couldn't go anywhere, and then the kids were at home. And then on top of that, I got a chance to really coach my kids, 10U and 6U in flag football. So I've been having a lot of fun with them and just really enjoying the time. You know, my time is coming gone, and I was mentally ready to move on.
See, that is really impressive to me, Lo, because for so many people, one, they don't prepare themselves either mentally or physically for it because it always seems to come sooner than people expect. It seems like you've made that transition and that adjustment beautifully. I'm curious, what kind of emotions have you had had watching the Bills and the kind of run they've had this season and the way they've been playing?
Really just a lot of excitement and enthusiasm for the guys, you know, almost like that proud uncle, you know, in a lot of ways, knowing a lot of those guys, knowing where that organization started from. You know, I was there in 16 before Sean and Brandon Bean, and the Pagulas really put their mark on the organization, and seeing the transition in culture has really been cool, and I was a part of it. You know, I had to obviously get out of the way so allow other guys to grow up and grow in the leaders that they are. We see the maturation of Josh Allen and Tremaine Edmonds, and to see those guys really take the lead and go a lot further than whatever I could ever do. It's really a cool moment to watch and see, and hopefully these guys can pull it out this weekend.
Lorenzo Alexander joining us. I think you had a lot to do with that. I think you played a huge part in helping to lay the foundation for what that team has accomplished so far. When you mentioned Josh, the thing that really jumps out to me, Lo, about Josh is his teammates and the way they talk about him and the way they love him, the way they believe in him. In your opinion, what makes him special? And when you have a quarterback like that that everybody believes in and wants to battle for, how powerful is that?
It's great. I mean, guys want to rally for him, run through a wall for him. It's like having a great coach that everybody respects and loves because they know they truly, genuinely love you. He's not a prima donna. He's a guy that works hard, grinds. You know, he had a lot of adversity as far as naysayers, as far as his ability, and he never allowed that to define him. And guys see that work ethic. And if you're ever in the locker room with him, and unfortunately, I got a lot of time to spend with him in training camp, sitting next to him messing with me, playing Bieber. He was never a guy that seemed unapproachable, right? And you have sometimes when you have this persona about you as being the quarterback and being the man that you almost can't approach that guy. And you never get that sense. Even though he's young, he has a great ability just to relate to guys. And even with Diggs, him immediately getting there and feeling welcome as a part of the family, I think a lot of that has to do with Sean McDermott's culture that he developed. And Joshua just ran with that and really embodies that whole city very well as far as being blue-collar, hard-nosed, working, coming from Wyoming, a cold-weather city. And he just really fits well in there and has been a great ambassador for the culture as well as the city.
We are talking to Lorenzo Alexander. Since you mentioned Diggs, I want to get your thoughts on him because, I mean, he had an amazing year. I mean, a definite go-to number one wide receiver. But what did you think when that trade went down, Lorenzo? For instance, the team gave up a whole lot to get him, and there were some questions about what happened in Minnesota. Were you at all concerned about what they gave up and how he might fit in? What was your reaction when you first heard about the trade?
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, knowing the culture that had been established and how strong it was and what how good Sean had done it and the veterans that were in that locker room, any issues that Diggs had in Minnesota I knew wouldn't transfer over. I mean, when you're around the league as long as I've been, you hear a lot of guys, you talk about them. It just things happen when you have a relationship breakdown and things don't work in that situation and you need a change of scenery. And I knew Buffalo would offer that to him and anything that may have been maybe a little skeptical, I knew that the guys would lift him up, hold him up, encourage him, and then they would have success, obviously, has helped that transition as well. But I have a lot of respect for Brandon Bean and what he's done and the move that he's made prior to that. People have questioned him, and they've always seemed to work out. And so he's done a great job along with that front office staff as far as identifying talent, understanding who guys really are, and understanding that our locker room can absorb a certain guys and make them almost like when you go to the Patriots, you almost, as a player, you change. Buffalo is becoming that place, too, where you adopt that culture that has been established by the men in that locker room.
You know, it's so interesting. Like, you always talk about the Patriot way. Like, how would you describe the Bills way?
Yeah, you know what? It's really all based on love, respect, and allowing guys to be who they are within the context of team. And I think Sean McDermott does a great job, better probably than any coach I've been around as far as emphasizing those principles, living by them daily, and then always not taking it for granted, but always revisiting. You know, Sean is a teacher at heart, and he does an excellent job as far as communicating his vision to the guys and also empowering the players to extend that culture and vision into the locker room. And guys that have earned it have a lot of input and impact, I think, on the organization, on him personally, and then also on the younger guys in that locker room as well.
We were talking to Lorenzo Alexander, talking all things Bills. So, Lo, when you have a situation where the Bills are headed to Kansas City and it's not exactly clear who they're going to face at quarterback, what's it like in the week leading up to it when you're preparing for both quarterbacks?
It's not clear. Patrick Mahomes isn't playing.
Fair point. Okay, let me rephrase that question. Is there any doubt in your mind that Patrick Mahomes is going to play?
Man, he's going to start the game. He'll be out there. I mean, you can hear Andy Reid talking where he's at as far as the protocol. He's going to be getting all his reps. Even at this time of the year, a lot of the stuff is walkthrough anyway. So he'll be able to take part in a lot of the stuff that you may not have been able to do, whether if it was early in the season when you're really ramping up and trying to create that culture for your football team during the season. So it was never any doubt in my mind that he'd be ready to go, kind of seeing the hit, seeing how he reacted after. But if the case, let's say Henny does play, you really don't change that drastically. They're not like one is like a Lamar Jackson, the other one is a pocket passer. They're going to still run their system, right, the plays that they run. And they have great confidence in Chad because he's been in the league for a long time. And so Andy Reid has already talked about the confidence that he's had. He had that week 17 to prepare. So you prepare for Patrick and what the Chiefs like to do generally, and then when Chad comes in the game, maybe you can dial. You have a couple of things in your back pocket from a coordinator standpoint. Like if he gets in the game, we may do this because he's not as crisp or as good as Patrick Mahomes.
Dude, that was so funny. Is it not clear? Is it not clear? That made me laugh. So listen, if in fact they're going to run their system, like what is the best way to run a system? Like if Mahomes is playing and he's healthy, for instance, we saw the Ravens, they always try to blitz him and he just picks them apart. At the same time, you don't want to be so passive either. What is the best defensive approach in dealing with Mahomes?
You have to be able to mix it up. You have to have the personnel. You know, obviously, I really like Tre'Davious White, one of the best corners in the game. And so he matches up well. And so you don't feel as uncomfortable if you want to light a guy up. You know you're going to have some sticky coverage on the back end. As far as Matt Milano also being on Travis Kelce, he matches up really well with tight ends and has played. And you have to mix and match. And then you have to have guys stand up and make plays. At the end of the day, scheme is nice and it can get cute at times. But this is the players' league, and it's always about winning your one-on-one matchups. And so whether that comes in the front end, Ed Oliver, Jerry Hughes, somebody making a big play there. As I mentioned, Tre'Davious White or one of, you know, Poyer or Micah Hyde making a big play on the back end. That's what it's going to take. That's going to be the difference in this game, as we've seen constantly. Even going back to last week versus the Ravens, Taron Johnson, big time, playing quarters, comes back in, pick six, 101 yards, and that's ultimately the big difference in that game. It was nothing fancy, nothing sexy about what they were doing. Players making plays, and that's what it's going to come down to in this game.
Man, so true, right? There's so many playmakers on the defensive side of the ball, and that was such an enormous defensive effort by the Bills. Lorenzo, I get that there's unfinished business. I get that they're not happy just to be here. They want to finish this thing. But when you mentioned Taron, like, in a town like that, to make a play like that, does that play live on, like, forever in folklore and Bills lore?
Forever. I mean, there's no fan base like Bills Mafia, and I played in several different places, and there's just nobody close that I've experienced on and off the field. And they revere, you know, all those guys that have definitely earned it, you know, Thurman Thomas, Jim Kelly, Steve Tasker, guys that are still around, and they embrace that whole crew. It doesn't matter if you were Jim Kelly or the guy that was 53-man on the roster. If you was a part of those teams during those Super Bowl eras, they love you. And so Taron making that type of play, being a part of this new era of Bills players, he'll definitely always have a free meal at a whole bunch of restaurants. Especially if they go on to win the Super Bowl, wherever he decides to show up and come into town and support the team, he'll always have, you know, just have that revere and respect from the city and in town.
Lorenzo, you've been in it. You've been in that locker room. You've played in big games. What's your gut tell you? Does this feel like a team that can not only win it all, but win it all this year?
Yeah, I mean, they're hitting on all cylinders. They're playing good football at the right time. You know, obviously I'm very biased and I'm so connected, but even when I try to step back from it, I still think they have a great chance. The way Josh has been playing at an elite level, just his growth as far as handling situations, being calm and collective and making smart football decisions is probably his best thing that he's going to do. And so unlike maybe times we saw last year, maybe earlier this year, I don't think the moment would be too big. So I think they'll be able to put up points, be able to score. And the defense has really come on here strong of late as well and been opportunistic, scoring on defense, making plays. And if they can play good sound football and minimize their mistakes, and really make Patrick and them boys earn it, you know, they have a great shot. And, you know, obviously a lot of people are going to be naysayers, Buffalo Bills, national perspective. But if you watch this team all year, you've seen them grow, you see them dominate, and now they're playing good football on really in all three phases.
I love them, Lorenzo, because you're so good at it. Before you go, can you give me a thought or two about Tampa Bay and Green Bay? Can you break that down? Who do you like and why?
Wow. Well, you know, Aaron is one of my teammates from back in Cal, and I can't go against them. You know, the weather is going to be snowy out there, and we already saw what they was able to do maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago when Davante Adams was out there. It looked like he was on nice grass, 60 degrees outside, cutting and still eating people up. I think just the way they're playing offensively is really good. I do like the Tampa Bay's defense. So the first week they gave me a little bit of hesitance the way Taylor Heinicke kind of ate them up. But I think they was missing their lightning rod in Devin White. You saw him last week flying around, had 10 tackles, picked up a fumble, interception. So it's going to be a close one. Obviously, time is going to be time. But I think ultimately because it's in Green Bay, that weather, most of those Tampa Bay boys don't really know what that means. Green Bay is going to pull this one off.
I think that weather's a factor. What about Tom? Like, as somebody who played in the league a long time, you know how tough it is to win in that league. Like Lorenzo, what's your reaction to a guy going to his 14th conference championship game?
It's phenomenal. He's the GOAT, obviously. It's all on, you know, him. This league is a players' league, as I mentioned earlier, and he is the all-time great and is able to get guys to buy in, cultivate. He's a leader. And I have a lot of respect for him. You know, a lot of people don't like him because of all the wins, but I have so much respect for playing against him and watching him and seeing the type of dude he is. His teammates love him, and, I got nothing but to tip my hat. And, you know, hopefully, you know, obviously for him, he wants to go out on top. But it's just amazing to watch. You know, I played 15 years, never won a playoff game. He's, what, in his 17th or 18th season, maybe a little bit older than that. And he's been to 14, as you just mentioned. I mean, it's just crazy. I mean, people don't really understand how hard it is to win in this league. For a guy to do that now with two different organizations is really impressive.
This is such a great conversation. One last thought, because you mentioned the fact that it is a players' league. I'm really curious about this. You were recently on Inside the League on Stadium. You talked about Urban Meyer and what it would be like to play for him in Jacksonville. Again, we're talking about a players' league, right? So he's been great in dealing with younger guys in college. How different is it when you're dealing with grown men with families and lives in the NFL?
Yeah.
And how do you think he'll relate?
Yeah, it's vastly different, and he's going to have to either talk to folks, make sure that, you know, whoever he brings in there has an idea of coaching grown men, you know, because I'm you know, I'm 38, four kids. He's also going to have some young kids in there. But I think his best bet is to obviously clean house as best as he can, bring in guys that are great character, leadership guys, pretty much what Sean McDermott did as far as the blueprint, that are hardworking. They may not be your apex all-star guys, but guys that understand culture and is going to really come alongside of him and help him become a better head coach and help him win that locker room and develop it into what he wants it to look like.
Does that sound like anybody you know, Lorenzo? Sounds like you, dude. Two-time Pro Bowler, an All-Pro, a Pro Bowl MVP, a Walter Payton Man of the Year nominee in 17, 18, 19, undrafted in 05 out of Cal and had an amazing career. Good friend of the program. Lorenzo, so good to have you back. I appreciate you, the relationship. Good luck this weekend.
Thanks, Jim, man. I'll talk to you soon, brother.
He is Vincent Goodwill. Vincent, listen, I've been wanting to talk to you for quite some time now. How you doing, man? How is life for you? What's going on?
Hey, this is a big thrill to be on with you. You got the whole bio, man. How you doing? This is pretty cool.
Dude, it's great. It's definitely good to talk to you. I've been reading you for a while, and I admire your work, and I wanted to get you on, so I'm glad you made time for it. I'm doing great. It's good to have you. So let me get your thoughts first on last night's Nets-Cavs game. You got a piece on that up on Yahoo right now. Going into the game, it was Kyrie Irving's first game back, his first game with KD and James Harden. What kind of expectations did you have for the Nets going into that game last night?
I think exactly what I saw, Jim. You know, I think one thing about Kyrie, even with all the madness and crazy that's surrounding him, nobody denies that he's an excellent performer. So watching those three together, they can all operate completely independently within themselves. I was curious to see how the pecking order was going to be established. I don't think we saw that. You're not going to usually see that in the first game. But I think with the way that we saw, when you got DeAndre Jordan as your one, you know, big man at this stage of his career, and none of these other guys are going to play defense, you're going to wind up giving up 150 points in a double overtime game. I expected them to win. I expected there to be, you know, some glaring points, but they lost, and there were still some glaring points, even though all three guys performed. And, Jim, that's the kind of like the, I want to say one of the bigger issues is, how do you convince guys that they didn't play well when everybody scored 30? Mm-hmm. Like, guys are wired to use the stat sheet as a, you know, measuring point for how they play. When everybody plays well and they look at the end of the night, I got my numbers, how do you tell them, hey, no, this isn't actually good enough?
Vincent Goodwill is joining us. You know, it's a really good point. Now, when you talk about guys who played well, nobody played better than Colin Sexton. He goes off for 42, and he was knocking down 1-3 after another in double OT. In terms of expectations, like, he's been averaging 27 a night, but what were your thoughts watching him and the way he's put things together in just his third year?
I didn't think that he would be this good this quick. Like, when you saw him at Alabama, you saw him as a rookie, you were like, okay, you know what? It's going to take him a little bit of time to put stuff together. And especially for rookie point guards in the league, you need reps. You need to be out there. You need the consistency. He's had multiple coaches, multiple setups. And then you throw a pandemic in the middle of his second season where he doesn't get a chance to really fully complete it. And then you start this type of unorthodox setup. So for him to be where he is now, on this young team that's had more roster upheaval and everything else, he's way ahead of the curve. And I think a lot of people are starting to catch up to him and say, you know what, he's not a guy that we can just forget about. You know, you normally think of young point guards as in the Ball Kids and De'Aaron Foxes. You don't really think about Colin Sexton until he shows up and does to Kyrie what he did to Kyrie with Kyrie's shoes in Kyrie's former building, with Kyrie's old number. That was a message he sent last night.
Vincent Goodwill breaking it down for us. So back to the Nets offense for a minute. Like you point out, these guys got theirs. They got their numbers, and they're putting up big points, and they're scoring the ball. Any concern, though, that there was a lot of dribbling from each guy last night? Like, is that just a first-game thing, or might that be an ongoing issue?
Have you seen Kyrie Irving and James Harden's movies?
Yeah, I have, too.
Dribble the ball into dust. It's like the flake gate of the basketball syndrome, essentially, in terms of how they're going to play. Like, I think it's going to be on Steve Nash, and it's going to be on these players to sacrifice styles of play. To me, Kevin Durant is the best basketball player on earth. Everything that they do should be revolving around, let's make KD as best as he can be. And basically, to me, that's not Kyrie and James dribbling it all around and basically doing their Harlem Globetrotters routine. I think that's going to take time. But I think when you look at the essence of both of these players when they're in their natural habitat, it's a bunch of guys watching and these guys doing their things. Like, this is what the Nets bought into. And until you change the habits, which can't be changed in a day or even a month. We won't see this finished product, Jim, for quite a long time, but it's going to take some actual sacrifice, some actual coaching, and some actual coaxing to get these guys to sacrifice a little bit.
Vincent Goodwill is joining us. Do you think that we're going to see the sacrifice that you just mentioned, the necessary sacrifice, and the actual coaching from Steve Nash? Can they put this all together between now and the end of the year?
I would like to say yes, but history usually tells us that it takes over a year. When you look at Miami with LeBron and D-Wade, and those guys were at different stages of their careers and had different levels of friendships and everything else, and they had a coach in Eric Spoelstra that had been around the coaching ranks a little bit longer than Steve Nash. Not to say that Steve Nash can't develop that, you know, that sort of institutional knowledge and everything else, but he's going through this for the first time. And we're in the midst of a pandemic, so you don't have the practice time, the bonding time, those honest, real conversations with each other where you got to say, you know what, even though I have the matchup tonight, Kevin, I'm giving you the ball. I wonder if you need a little bit of failure before you come to that acceptance. But, Jim, when you look at them on paper, there's no reason why they should not be, at the very least, in the Eastern Conference Finals in a stacked Eastern Conference, whether it's against Philly or against Milwaukee or against whoever you put there. They should be there because they have the talent. And that was also going to be on Sean Marks to sort of fill in the blanks with all these other little holes that they have that these guys aren't capable of filling. But can they put it together? Yeah. Will they have that acceptance? I still need to wait and see.
Vincent Goodwill killing that jungle debut so far. So, Vincent, let me ask you something. You mentioned COVID. This month you've written a couple of pieces on the topic of the COVID vaccine and the NBA, and you've addressed the issue of institutional racism and why some players might be wary of the vaccine. How do you see the league approaching this?
I think all you can do, Jim, is educate players and give them the knowledge armed to make certain decisions. A, there's a lot that we don't know about, not necessarily the vaccine, but there's a lot we don't know about COVID. COVID is relatively new. We don't know what it's going to not just mutate into, but we don't know some of the side effects. And from a long-term standpoint, those are reasonable concerns that players will have. A lot of this distrust that you have comes from generational knowledge that you hear from your family. Well, the Tuskegee thing and everything else, and there's a natural mistrust from Black folks of the medical profession and the government, and they're not necessarily on base to have those concerns. But if you're the NBA, you kind of come to them and say, look, if there's some people that the government or whoever is going to screw over, it's probably not going to be the guy making $30 million a year that's providing entertainment. So you got to kind of make your decision with a little more of a knowledge base as opposed to some of the historical things that have happened. It's a really complicated situation, Jim, because you can't tell people that the history with Black folks, which is talking about a Black league, I'm not discounting the international players, the white players or whatever, but you're talking about a 70% Black league. And you can't tell players to discount what they've seen, whether it's, you know, with the medical profession, whether it's with the government, whatever. You can't tell them that doesn't matter. But all you can do is give them all the knowledge necessary. And add to the fact, Jim, we're talking about like 1,000 people, by and large. You're talking about players, staff, support staff. We're talking about 1,000 people. To me, that's not necessarily jumping the line when you get so many, you know, vaccines that aren't being used because of the way that it's been distributed in an, you know, in an inefficient fashion.
So, Vincent, where do you come out on this then? When you talk about the stain left by the Tuskegee experiment and the overall experience of what it is to receive health care in the United States if you're Black, it has been suggested, and this is what we're talking about, that NBA players might be the face of receiving the vaccine. Overall, where do you come out on that idea? Is that a good idea?
I think here's the thing. If NBA players are among the most trusted African-American and influential African-Americans in the country, that's just the way that this is set up. If you're not Barack Obama or Michelle or someone of that ilk that is universally respected, universally loved and trusted, you're probably an NBA player just because NFL guys wear helmets and just the way the structure is. If you do your research, and for me, Jim, it comes down to this. You know what happens if you don't take the vaccine? There's 400,000 dead bodies in the United States. I don't want to take that chance. I'm sure all these people want to see their parents, want to see their friends, want to see, you know, lack of a better phrase, some of their other friends too. So I would say, yeah, you should probably take the vaccine, not just for the greater good of everybody else in the world, but for the greater good of yourself and your own circle.
Vincent Goodwill is my guest. Let me ask you this. On Martin Luther King Day, you did a video piece for Yahoo on the connections, Vincent, between Martin Luther King and the NBA. How would you sum up and describe those connections?
It, to me, is really, really simple. You know, MLK used this great weapon when he was, you know, when he was at the height of his powers, when, you know, he was going through the South and everything. He used shame on America. And that shame was, you're not treating your people the way that you purport yourselves to. With the NBA, David Stern didn't use shame, but he appeared to the, let's say, aspirational part of MLK, where you're not so racist that Julius Erving and Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan can't appear in your living rooms and in front of you, and you can't connect with them and you can't love them. It's not necessarily the same thing. It's like two sides of a different coin. One side appears to shame, another side appears to the better part of yourself. But the NBA as a whole is this thing that says, hey, you're not, even if we feel like you are racist, we're going to tell you that you're not so racist, that you can invest in this product, invest in these black faces, and you will deal and you will be fine. And to large measure, they've been right.
We are talking to Vincent Goodwill, a senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports. Let me ask you one last thought. Last year, in the wake of David Stern's passing, you wrote about how he and the league handled race. What did you make of his approach?
I think it was like two-pronged, because I certainly just mentioned the aspirational part of it, right? You know, just basically saying it was the perception of the league was totally different. You know, in 1984 when he took over, some of the games were on tape delay. You couldn't even see Magic and Bird and everything else when it was happening. I can't imagine live basketball, live sporting events, you know, being played on a tape delay in certain parts of the country. So David Stern, to some degree, appealed to middle America in the way that not many people have been able to reach before or since. He was a master in that way. He was a master in a way of being able to show people, hey, you can be your best self, and you can see some of yourself in some of these, you know, genetically gifted guys that you will actually have no connection to. And then there's the backside of David Stern, which was, you know, some of the after effects of the brawl and the dress code, which at the time, Jim, I was 21, 22 years old, college student just getting out. I thought that was inherently racist. And even though I thought it was inherently racist, I can't deny that it worked. You know what I mean? Like, even if the roots, I think, were, I won't say negative, but it appealed to the worst part of people. It appealed to people's fears and their misperceptions. It worked because NBA players took it to a completely different level on how they dressed and how they were looked at by the masses, and they wound up getting the endorsements back from an individual standpoint. And now you see the pendulum flip the other way, where Adam Silver's like, hey, guys, we already have this level of respect from the public. You guys can be who you are. You can see some of the things that Adam Silver has built upon the foundation that David Stern laid.
Vincent Goodwill, we've covered so much ground, some actually pretty heady topics. I'm really glad that you could do that. Last thought, and I normally don't keep a guest this long, but this is so, so good. What was it like? I mean, I mentioned in the open, you are the pride of Detroit. What was it like to cover the Pistons for the Detroit News as long as you did?
Well, luckily for me, Jim, I came after the really, really good team. Like my team growing up was the Bad Boys. Those were the teams of my childhood. So the connection was kind of gone by, you know, covering all of them. But it's almost like anything else. You're seeing how the sausage is made. So you lose a lot of the fandom even before you take over. But then all of a sudden you become the villain of Detroit because you're writing about a semi-bad team with a little bit of drama, and you're tarnishing some of the sheen off of guys who won a championship. That ain't necessarily the best villain, but it was still kind of fun, though. Who doesn't like being a contrarian? I mean, I'm talking to Jim Rome here.
Got to, dude. You got to go the other way. But you got to go the other way, but you know this already. Don't go the other way just to go the other way, because then people know you're full of crap. You know, it can't be contrived. It can't be manufactured. Man, don't be a part of that hot take lava factory. Go the other way, but go the other way because you really believe that that's the way you feel, and that's the way it is.
You got to be genuine. And in Detroit, the one thing people can spot off is a contrarian just for contrarian sake or fraud. Like, we are, I'm going to say we're simple middle America, but we got a BS meter that we can sniff out that stuff a mile away. So the one thing I always try to be, the one thing anybody should be in this business, is authentic. And if you're not, I think by and large, people sniff out a fraud a mile away. I think it's just more so in Detroit just because of how we're wired.
I was going to say the word is authentic. You got to be authentic. Authenticity is the thing because people can't sniff that out. He is a senior writer for Yahoo. He did cover the Bulls for NBC or NBA Sports Chicago. He covered the Pistons for the Detroit News. Vincent, like I said, man, I've been reading you and following you for quite some time. I wanted to get you on the program, and you just smashed it. Great job. Appreciate you, and I know we'll do it again soon.
Hey, appreciate it. Can you get a rack on at the end of this just so I can feel good?
Yeah, I can do that. Rack it, man. That was awesome.
Good night now!